Okay, plant friends, I think we all at some point have had a fishbowl with a goldfish or a betta fish in it, growing up in our homes or in our classrooms, but I was totally unaware of an entire subsect of the plant community, the planted aquarium world. I feel like recently I've been seeing a lot of planted aquariums on Instagram, and they've piqued my curiosity. There is this whole corner of the plant community dedicated to elevating our common fish tanks to living, growing underwater worlds that look like actual art. Aquatic gardeners, which is, I think, a really cute term, are using aquatic plants, which are plants that can live underwater, to aquascape insanely beautiful aquariums. It's biophilia at its highest sense because you have so many aspects of the natural world indoors. You've got water, you've got plants, and you even have little cute fishies. I had many of you request this episode, but to be frank, it's taken me a minute to get around to it because I'm totally out of my depths when it comes to dealing with underwater houseplants. I've got the above ground houseplants down, but I really needed to find an expert who I could talk to about this topic. And I knew Karen was our gal. She's an avid aquatic gardener, and she's actually written a step-by-step tutorial on how to assemble planted aquariums. But this chat is all about the basics of aquatic plants and planted aquariums. So, plant friends, for lack of a better word, get ready to dive into this wild world of aquatic plants and gardening underwater in episode 135 of Blue Mangrove Radio. Hello, my beautiful plant friends. I hope you've had beautifully planty weeks. At this point, I'm just getting back from my honeymoon. I can't wait to tell you more about our delightfully planty wedding and the planty honeymoon we took as well. Plant friends, I'm so excited about this episode on aquatic plants. It's really a whole different art than house plants. It requires different plants. It requires a different set of skills and knowledge about what it takes to plant plants underwater. It requires different growing media. It requires an intense knowledge of water and bubbling and all sorts of stuff, which we're about to learn in this conversation. So, you know, this is not going to be a tutorial. There's too much to understand in this entirely separate kind of subsect of the plant community. So consider this conversation with Karen an exploratory conversation on the wild world of aquatic plants and how planted aquariums work. We're kind of laying the groundwork for, like, what are these things? How do these things work? Karen kind of dives into a lot of really interesting facts and insight about that. And then if you're interested in assembling one of these tanks for yourself, I totally recommend getting Karen's book. She has a step-by-step guide. There are amazing planty YouTube channels that are dedicated to the art of planting up aquariums. There's a lot of really rich information in Karen's book and on the internet about taking the next step. And also, if you like this information, if you are interested in more deep dives on aquatics, let me know. Maybe we'll schedule a 2.0 or 3.0 follow-up episode like we did with Semihydro. So let me know if you're interested in that in the Garden Party platform. All right, plant friends, once again, I can't stop using this pun for this episode, but let's dive into the conversation. Here's Karen. Welcome to Bloom and Grow Radio, Karen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on the show and finally get an episode on aquatic plants because this has been a really top requested episode for a lot of our listeners, but something that's really intimidated me because I know zero about aquatic plants and planted aquariums, or I think you call it underwater gardening. Is that what it's called?
Aquatic gardening.
Aquatic gardening. Yeah. So I'm very excited to pick your brain and learn the basics. So before we dive into the wild world of aquatic plants, how did you become the plant lady, the sunken garden expert that you are today?
My parents had aquariums when they were kids, so aquariums have always been in my life. My first memory of aquarium stuff was being allowed to pick out a Blackmore goldfish at the pet shop and bringing it home in the Chinese food container because we didn't have plastic bags back then. So we've always had aquariums, and there weren't plastic plants then. So if you had plants in your aquarium, they were real plants. So I've always had plants in the aquariums. And I've always been a plant person, too. I've always had gardens. I've always had house plants. I have vivariums all over my house. So plants are just what I do, and the fish along with them. So.
And did you go to school for plants as well?
No, Not at all. I actually went to school for art and then I worked in the banking industry for 13 years. So what I went to school for had nothing to do with what I did for work. And then I switched from banking to working as an educational advocate for children with special needs.
And this has just always been kind of your through line hobby. That's very interesting. I think a lot of professionals in gardening find their profession in gardening in a very like roundabout way. There's a lot of people who are self-taught and figure it out and become experts just by doing the hard work and putting your 10,000 hours in.
Yeah, this has never been a profession for me ever. It's still not. I mean, I don't work professionally in the plant world at all. This is all hobby.
And yet you've written an amazing book on how to plant aquariums.
Well, and I travel all over the world studying aquatic plants in the wild. COVID obviously has shut all of that down, but that's what I love doing is getting out into the wild and studying plants in the wild.
On this podcast a lot, we talk about having houseplants and trying to kind of understand where they come from in the wild and then kind of replicating to the best of our ability in our heated homes like that situation. And I noticed in your book, you have a lot of photos of these aquatic plants in their natural habitats. And so I'm sure with planting aquatic plants, really understanding what those ponds, oceans, lakes look like in real life must really serve understanding how to plant up a aquarium.
Well, and I think that that's why I like aquariums and vivariums, because you can create an environment for the plants that you can't with houseplants. You know, again, because of the dry environment in our houses, our houseplants are always struggling to survive with the amount of light and humidity that we have in our houses. Either the cactuses because we don't have enough light for them, or all the other plants because we don't have enough humidity for them. There are very few plants that would actually live in the kind of conditions that we have inside our houses. But inside a glass box, we can create whatever environment we want, whether it's terrestrial or underwater. And that's why I love those little worlds.
I feel like lately on Instagram, I've been seeing a lot of these planted aquariums. I feel like they're kind of coming back into popularity. Why do you think that this planted aquarium style is becoming more and more popular?
Well, I think that COVID has a lot to do with just like houseplants. People are stuck inside. I think a lot of hobbies have done extremely well because of COVID, because people are stuck inside. They can't go out and do all their social things that they have been able to do so much. And so they're looking for other things to spend their money on. And I think that a lot of the hobby people were thinking that they were really going to go bottom up at the beginning of COVID, and they found that they've done extremely well, both in the houseplant world and in the aquarium world. And I think aquatic plant world has been part of that. But the aquascaping has just been on an upward trajectory really for the last 20, 25 years. It's been on a steady upward trajectory. Marine reef tanks had a little bit of an advantage in terms of people knowing what they were and getting excited about them. I mean, they're holding their own, but planted tanks have really, really taken off. And I think more people are doing planted tanks now than are doing reef tanks.
Yeah. And it's such an art. I mean, what comes to mind for me is I think people are really looking to connect with nature on a different level after COVID, being indoors. And from like a biophilic perspective, humans are innately like connected to plants and animals. So I feel like to have fish, like living, swimming fish combined with living plants. And there's something so like gentle and beautiful about the way the plants kind of sway in the water that you don't necessarily see in just like a basic houseplant, like sitting on your table. There's like a feeling of life, I feel like, in a planted aquarium that is kind of exacerbated than just like looking at a normal house plant in a pot, if that makes sense.
If you're doing it right, they also grow faster. And I think that part of the house plant excitement is propagating and sharing. But house plants, I mean, a few of them grow really fast, but a lot of them grow really slowly.
Yeah, totally.
And that's true with aquatic plants, only the other way around. Most of them grow really fast. A few of them grow really slowly. And actually, the more beginner plants tend to be the ones that grow the slowest. But a lot of plants grow really, really fast. Once you get the key to figuring out how to grow plants well, you are just overrun with plants all the time. And people are trading plants. And again, just like with houseplants, they tend not to trade hands at the same nosebleed prices that some of the houseplants do. But still, people pay ridiculous amounts of money for the new plants on the market, the new things that come in and the new varieties that show up. And just like with houseplants, the ones that the white ones and the pink ones that don't have a lot of chlorophyll, they don't do particularly well. And they do even worse under water. And people still want them and pay lots of money for them because they look different. And they take them home and they kill them and they buy new ones for lots of money. So
how do you trade aquatic plants? Like, because with houseplants, you know, you wrap the roots in a wet paper towel and you do the swap, but an aquatic plant has to be underwater, right? So how do you do that trade?
You wrap it in a wet paper towel and you put it in a plastic bag and send it off in the mail.
And say a prayer.
No, they do very well. The thing is, almost all of the plants that we call aquatic plants are actually plants that grow both underwater and above the water, depending on the time of year. There are only a handful of plants that are obligate aquatics that have to grow underwater. And those need to be handled a little differently. But almost all of the plants that we grow in the aquarium can grow either above the water or below the water. So you can either transition them and send the immersed growth, which is the above water growth, around, which is much sturdier, or you can be a little more careful with it and send the submersed growth around. And the other interesting thing is a lot of these plants are also aeroids, which are all, you know, all the rage in the houseplant world.
Yeah. So the perfect transition. So before we dive into like what a planted aquarium needs, let's just talk about aquatic plants, because this is something that I don't understand how plants can grow underwater with the absence of oxygen.
There's no absence of oxygen. How can fish live in the water?
Well, I guess a very different ratio of oxygen. So can you kind of break down like what an aquatic plant is? I know that there are several different types of aquatic plants. How are they different than, you know, the terrestrial plants that we know and love?
The top layer of the plant leaf is thinner on plants that are growing underwater. Again, I'm making generalities here because there are some plants that are different, but most of them, if you're talking about a plant that can grow either immersed or submersed, the ones that have transitioned to submersed growth, the leaves will be much thinner. And that's because they need to be able to take oxygen, but even more importantly, carbon dioxide out of the water and nutrients because they feed largely through their leaves. They also feed through their roots, but they largely feed through their leaves directly out of the water. And they photosynthesize through their leaves also. And that all has to take place right on the leaf surface. So the leaves become much more flexible and soft and able to move in the water current. Also, they need to not be ripped off in the water current, so they have to be able to move more easily. And then when the water level goes down and the plant comes up out of the water, not those leaves. Those leaves usually die off and then they produce leaves that are harder and more able to stand up to the time that they're above the water.
So the plants have kind of adapted and made it possible for them to kind of live both above and below.
Yes.
So what are the five different types of aquatic plants and which ones are we focusing on for our planted aquariums?
So it's not so much that there are five different types. All of those types can have uses in the aquarium because there are some that are fully obligate aquatics that can never grow out of the water. Kabomba would be one of those. Their flowers come up above the top of the water, but the plant never, ever grows out of the water. There are floating plants that grow floating on the top of the water. Their leaves are floating, but their roots are in the bottom and they have a long petiole, and that's the stem of the leaf, and that gets longer and longer as to reach up to the surface of the water, and then the leaf itself floats on the water, and the flower itself floats on the water. But that's a plant that's rooted in the bottom, so that's yet another type. Then there are the plants that are marginal plants that grow sort of at the edge of the water, and depending on the time of year, the water may be lower it can happen for a number of reasons. There's many places that are tidal but are not estuarial, so they don't have salt in the water, but they're close enough to the ocean that the water pushes back up in there. So it's totally fresh water, but the water gets higher and lower with the tides. And so the water can get higher and lower even in the course of the day. And so for part of the day, the plants are out of the water, and part of the day they're in the water, so that you can have that kind of partially in and partially out of the water. And then there are other areas where there's a dry season and a wet season, so that the plants are out of the water for part of the year. And so those marginal plants, again, have to adapt to being out of the water part of the year. Some of them totally die back for part of the year, either when they're in the water or they're out of the water. Again, depends on the plant. And others adapt by changing their foliage to a different kind of foliage. And then there are plants like cattails that grow with their feet in the water, but they always have their foliage out of the water. And those would be plants that we don't use in the aquarium, but are very often used by pond people, like at the edge of their pond, like sedges, things like that.
Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled? Or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. We just moved and we have a pond on our property, and there's like a beautiful patch of cattails that it's so nice to just watch them blow in the wind. So it sounds like there's all sorts of different types of plants that you can play with when creating a aquarium or even like a fishbowl. Ones that are either fully submerged, which you called
obligate.
Then you have plants that float on the top of the water and their roots are on top of the water.
Yeah, that would be like duckweed or water lettuce or azolla or things like that.
Okay. Then we have the plant that the roots are submerged in the bottom of the water, and then the lily pad with their petiole, the leaf actually sits on top of the water to photosynthesize.
Roots are actually in the substrate, not just in the water, but in the substrate.
Right, the bottom of the pond or the aquarium, whatever. Then we have the really interesting ones that have adapted to be able to be both in and out of water.
That's 85 to 90% of the plants that we use.
Really? Okay. The ones that can be both in and out. So you could have a really cool sculpted aquarium where some of the plants are sticking out of the water.
Yeah, most people don't do that, but yeah, you could. Then you get into paludariums, which is a specific type.
Right, a whole different episode for that. But I guess because they've adapted to be both in and out of the water, they're easy to work with for aquariums because they know how to be underwater full time.
Well, first of all, they're the most interesting in terms of there's more colors and more leaf variety. And that's just the majority of the plants that we use. But they also, from a commercial standpoint, they're the easiest to propagate because any plants that you can grow immersed can be grown fastest because they have better access to CO2 and light because they're not getting it through the water. And you don't have to fight the pests that you have to fight underwater, which are algae and snails and things like that. And so it's much easier to control them in a greenhouse setting. So the growers much prefer to deal with anything that they can grow immersed and then either sell them or also they transport much easier in that sturdier immersed growth.
Okay. So sorry, you've been saying immersed. What do you mean by immersed in terms of propagation?
Immersed is above the water.
With an E.
Yes.
Okay.
And submersed is below the water.
Okay, so I feel like that's important keywords for us to understand for this conversation because initially I was hearing it differently. So you're saying more than that are immersed plants that can be propagated out of the water because it's easier to grow them quickly. So that's a lot of the plants that we're working with when we talk about aquariums.
Yeah, it's not just quickly, it's well and easier to transport. And there's just so many reasons that it's better for the end user and it's better for the transport. And yeah, there's just so many reasons that it works out better for everybody for those plants and pest control. And yeah, nobody likes algae. Nobody likes snails. And so, you know, if you can get the plants to the end user without those things, they're much happier.
So when these plants are underwater, they're still performing the same processes that they are if they were out. They're still photosynthesizing underwater, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around the fact that these plants would, I mean, I know it's an adaptation and I know it's true because I see all of these beautiful aquariums, but it is just kind of wild to wrap your head around. Okay. So say I'm me and I am a plant person interested in maybe getting a little pet fish and setting up one of these beautiful planted aquariums. I want to do live plants in an aquarium. So a planted aquarium, no fake plants. But I just don't know where to start. Like, what are the basic components that I would need to have a successful planted aquarium with live plants?
I would say these days I would get one of the nicer, higher end kit nano aquariums, like the Fluval Spec 5 is a good starting place for somebody. Filtration is built in on the end, so it's all hidden. You don't have to worry about stuff that's showing. And it has a light that's built into it that if anything, it's on the too strong side, but there's ways of modifying that. And again, get into that, but it just takes too long. And Fluval also makes a very good substrate that grows plants well. And I know we're going to talk about this later, so we'll table it for the moment. But then there's a group of plants that are very easy for beginners to use that don't grow too quickly. And in a small 5-gallon tank, you don't want plants that are going to grow really, really fast, or you'll have fun with them for the first month. And then after that, you'll just be cursing me because they'll be outgrowing the tank on a regular basis. And a tank like that, and then you'd need to get a very small heater because a betta, which is pretty much the only fish that you can put in a tank that small, needs heat. And then you need, from my perspective, you need hardscape material, which would mean rocks and some aquarium safe wood. And the best place to get that is at your pet store. And you make your hardscape and then you plant around it and you're ready to go. If you want to put a fish in, you also do need to learn about cycling the aquarium. The easiest way with a planted tank for a beginner is to get some cycled material, either from somebody you know who's got a cycled aquarium, cycled filter material, or barring that, if that's not a possibility, just set up the tank and don't put anything in it. Be patient. Patience is totally undervalued in the aquarium world, as in the houseplant world, and wait a month. And if you wait a month and everything's going well, you can put your fish in and you just don't need to worry about it. It's when people rush things, buy the fish first and then set up the tank that they run into problems. But if you wait a month after you set up the tank, you won't have a problem at all.
Interesting. So what does cycled mean?
This doesn't have anything to do with the plants. This gets into the bacterial processes that go on in an aquarium, and this is any aquarium, whether it has plants in it or not, the plants actually help. You know, there's a whole huge chapter in my book about this, that a lot of chemistry that goes into aquarium keeping, and there's something called the nitrogen cycle, and there's a lot of waste material that builds up in an aquarium from plant leaves that are deteriorating, from the fish waste, from bacteria breaking down, from everything that goes on in the tank. And that first turns into ammonia, and ammonia is toxic to the plants and to the fish. And then there's a bacteria that processes that into nitrite, which is even more toxic. And then there's another bacteria that processes that into nitrate, which is, for all intents and purposes, until it gets into very, very high concentrations, it's not toxic. Plants can use ammonia and ammonium. Ammonium is their preferred form of nitrogen in the aquarium. They can use nitrite and they can use nitrate. So they can use any of those forms of nitrogen. So they kind of short circuit this whole thing, but they have to have started growing. That's why if you leave them for a month, you're all set, and they will help you with the nitrogen cycle. But you have to give them a chance to settle in and start doing their work.
You're basically setting up, microclimate isn't the right word. You're setting this like environment up, this contained environment. And once you've planted it, it hasn't had time to breathe and photosynthesize and do the processes. So you leave it for a month.
And those bacteria haven't had a chance to
do their job and settle in. So it's like kind of if you've been rooting a plant in the houseplant world, like when you root plants in water and then you finally plant it up into substrate, you like leave the plant's substrate like wetter than normal as it adjusts, and you give it this like adjustment period before you start really treating it like its normal houseplant self.
Yeah, as far as the plants are concerned, for sure. That's exactly, yeah, because the plant just needs time. But then the other part of it that you can't see is, you've also got these little bacteria that you can't see at all, but they're really important to what's going on in the tank. And you also need to give them a chance to build up. Now, in the fish tank world, they're in there with test kits and they're testing for the ammonia and then they're testing for the nitrite and they're testing for the nitrate. And the problem with that in a planted aquarium is that the plants are already also using that ammonia and nitrate. And so the plants interrupt your being able to test for those things, and they can confuse a beginner. You know, a more experienced person can just like with houseplants, you can look at your plants and you kind of know what's going on and you know when things are going okay. And I hardly ever use test kits except to kind of verify what I already know or to answer somebody else's questions or to troubleshoot an aquarium for somebody else. But in my home aquariums, I just don't use test kits because I don't need to. But with beginners, they're told, get these test kits and test every day. You know, when you need to see the ammonia go up and then you see the nitrite go up. And when the ammonia and nitrite go down and the nitrate goes up, you know that your tank is cycled. But that doesn't happen in a planted aquarium because the plants are using the ammonia and the nitrite. So they never see that happen, and they think the tank hasn't cycled. And that's not really what's happening. It's that the plants are using the nitrogen products because they're eating it.
So that's why you suggest just waiting a month. And a month is a very safe place to consider that it's cycled.
If you watched that little video I sent you, you saw me put the fish right in, and I had just set that tank up. And the reason for that is that I had taken filter material out of another tank that I have, because I have lots of tanks, and it was fully cycled filter material that was already full of that good bacteria. And so I didn't need to wait because the tank already had that good bacteria, and all of those plants had been taken out of other tanks that I had because.
Got it. So if you have a fish tank friend or another fish tank, you can kind of accelerate that. So the bacteria you keep talking about, do the bacteria occur naturally once you've planted the plants because of the plants and the substrate you're planting in? Or do you have to like kind of inoculate the water with whatever bacteria you need?
They're everywhere. They're just in the environment. They just show up and do
so
their
don't
job.
Worry about them. They're going to be there. They're partying. We just can't see them.
Yeah, you can go and buy bottles, supposedly, of that stuff. I don't have a lot of faith in that. There's a company called Fritz that has a better reputation for actually being able to store that bacteria in a bottle and have it actually stay alive. Fritz is probably the only brand that I would trust as far as actually being able to get live bacteria to you in a plastic bottle. If I had to start from scratch, for instance, the guy next door came over and said, here's a betta. I don't want it anymore. You have it. And I had to set up something for a fish today, and I didn't have any other filter material of my own. I would go to the local pet store and I would ask them to squeeze out a sponge filter into a plastic bag, and I'd take that home and pour it through my new filter. That's the best, freshest bacteria you can possibly get. And most any independent pet store will do that for you.
Right. But that's an interesting way to do it. So you mentioned filters. So what is the importance of filters? Because I feel like a lot of people probably think, oh, I'll buy some plants, I'll buy some substrate, I'll plant them up, and it'll be great. What's the filter and what's the bubbler? And are they the same thing?
Bubblers have nothing to do with plants. You don't want a bubbler. All that does is push CO2 out of the tank. Again, that's something that has only to do with fish tanks that don't have plants in them. Filters serve multiple different purposes, and there's only three main purposes in a planted tank. They mechanically filter debris out of the water. They move the water around, which is good for the plants because just like you want air movement around your plants that are terrestrial, you want water movement around your water plants. And the filter itself, which is usually some kind of sponge material, it's one of the homes for bacteria that do this processing of the nitrogen wastes in the tank.
That's why you say if you go get the fish water from the local store, you run it through the filter and you don't just dump it into the water because you want that bacteria to make its home in the filter.
I mean, you could just dump it into the tank, but that would make a god-awful mess. If you put it through the filter, you're just not going to make such a big mess in your tank.
Because it's going to clean it out and filter it as it. Okay. Wow. Those are some interesting aquarium hacks. I like that. So is a filter 100% necessary? Can you try and set up an aquarium without one?
It's not 100% necessary. You can set up a tank without it. And would I suggest that a beginner try it? Absolutely not.
Okay. Okay.
It's jumping in the deep end of the pool without ever having a swimming lesson.
Got it. Because one of our listeners wrote in saying, what's the best way to control algae with no filtration system? I have a small Japanese Zen water garden and it's getting a little green. It looks like there's moss growing on the surface of the water. Should I use a strainer every now and then to swipe it off?
Okay. First of all, I'm not a pond person. So
okay.
Second, that's not moss, it's algae. Third, ponds need filtration just as much as aquariums, but more. And so she's got a problem there. I do know enough about ponds to know that they need filtration too. And so that it's going to be a constant problem for her that she doesn't have filtration. What specifically she needs to do to solve that problem. I mean, yes, she can manually remove the algae that she's got. I wouldn't be using a strainer. I'd just pick it off the top with my hands, but that's me.
Okay. So basically, there's no way to kind of mitigate it. If you don't have a filter, there's going to be algae. And yes, you're going to have to kind of scrape it off. It sounds like your recommendation is to put a filter in it. Can you buy just like a small filter and pop it in like an already established water garden like he's mentioning? Or, you know,
I can't imagine she can't put a filter on it. It seems unlikely.
Got it. Thank you to our episode sponsor, Soltech Solutions. Plant friends, it's fall. I know I'm a fall girl. I'm basic. Winter is like literally around the corner. It's so cold. It's chilly. So we're all making our winter preparations with swapping out our clothes and drinking a lot of pumpkin spice lattes. But have you prepped your plants for winter? If you haven't, Soltech Solutions has you covered with their full spectrum photosynthetic grow lights that give off a warm, white, cozy glow. No more dead plants or harsh looking grow lights in your house. I always get compliments on the Aspect pendant style hanging lamp. People think that they're just normal lights, and then I get to nerd out and tell them that they're actually grow lights. So Soltech Solutions sleek and modern grow lights make sure that your plants are getting the proper amount of light that they need all year round, even when there's less light availability in the winter. And they seamlessly fit into your home decor, so modern and sleek looking. You can choose from a variety of selection of grow lights now that Soltech has. Whether you're looking for what they're most famous for, the Aspect light, which is their pendant style hanging light. I have three of them in my home. Maybe you're looking for track lighting to light a green wall or a larger plant installation or a plant that's in a hard to reach place. Or maybe you're just looking for a simple grow bulb to screw into any standard light fixture. Whatever you need, they likely have an answer to your solution. They offer hassle-free quality products with great customer service, free shipping, a 5-year warranty, and more. And Plant Friends, it's gift-giving season soon, so this makes a great high-end gift. Keep your life and your plants green this fall and winter with Soltech Solutions. Use code BLOOMGROW2021 at checkout for 15% off at soltechsolutions.com. Once again, that's BLOOMGROW2021 at soltechsolutions.com. You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutri-Greens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutri-Greens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. Now, in the lane of filtration, let's talk about water. So I have learned, because I moved to the country and now I have well water, there's all sorts of water, hard water, soft water, tap water. For beginners, are we using tap water and then just trusting the filter? Like, how does that work in terms of water? Do you have to buy distilled water to set this up?
No, I would say probably 75% of the people in the U.S. can use their tap water.
Okay.
It will depend somewhat on the kind of water you have, what plants will work best for you. But the easiest beginner plants will work in a very, very wide range of water supplies. Unfortunately, water in the U.S. is becoming more and more of a problem in more and more areas. And it does pay to know what's in your tap water before you use it in your aquarium. And as far as I'm concerned, before you drink it. I mean, here in Holliston, we used to have very, very good water quality. We have terrible water these days. And we turned our downstairs shower into a RO water processing station where I make huge amounts of water every day for our drinking water and for the water that I use for my vivariums, for my aquariums, and for at least half of my houseplants because our water is so bad. And I wish it weren't the case. And I've cut back on the aquariums that I'm keeping just because making water is such a problem for me.
How do you figure that out? say I want to do my first aquarium. Is there a test that I buy to like figure that out, like an aquarium tap water test? Or
in some cases, it's easy. So in some cases, if you've got really hard water, the easiest thing to do is just to cut it with distilled water, or even, you know, the spring water from the grocery store is usually quite soft, and you can use part that water and part your own water and just get it to a level of hardness that's not too bad. In my case, it's not the hardness that's a problem. There's chemicals in it that are bad, and the fish were dying every time I did a water change, and it was not hardness. And that made me really concerned. At that point, my granddaughter was living with us. I got a water test from the town. I got a complete water analysis. And even that was not totally clear what the problem was. And I dug more deeply onto a government site, and I found that there's chemicals in the water here from an old paint. We have town wells, and that's the problem. And it was an old paint factory that has been leaching into the water here. And they're doing things. They're trying to clean it up, and probably within the next couple of years, it will get better. But they're digging new wells, deeper wells.
But how would I know to cut? Like, I love that suggestion to cut with, you know, half distilled, half tap. How would I know, like, what the ratio to cut?
You need a KH kit, a GH kit. You should have a pH kit on hand, but people get caught up on pH, and it's not that important. GH and GH are more important. You need a nitrate kit. You need a phosphate kit, particularly if you live in the middle of the country, because in the middle of the country, there's a lot of leaching from fertilizers into tap. Or if you live near a golf course, because golf courses put a lot of fertilizers on their golf courses, and that gets into tap water nearby. And nitrate and phosphate in the tap water is not necessarily a problem for a planted tank in terms of it's not going to hurt the plants, but it can be an algae problem. It can turn your tank into an algae farm. So you might want to, at least in the beginning stages, set the tank up with water that doesn't have so much nitrate and phosphate in it. And then as you do water changes, you just make sure that the amount that you're putting in, you're thinking about your water changes being your fertilizer, as you put it.
When you say water change, how often do you recommend changing the water? And is it a full drain the tank, put all fresh water in? Or is it like drain half the tank, put half fresh water in?
Until you know your tank and until you know what you're doing, I suggest 50% per week.
Per week. Every week you're changing the water. Okay.
Yeah, you should definitely be changing water pretty much once a week. A lot of people, as they get to know their tank better, particularly if it's a lower light tank with slower growth, can get by with a smaller amount of water and changing water every couple of weeks. But if you start out with too little, you're going to run into algae problems. If you start out with a good, strong amount of maintenance, and again, I suggest that people who are getting started start with a relatively small tank, with a 5 or 10 gallon tank. So really doing a water change is not that big a deal.
And what's the purpose of changing the water every week? What is that doing?
You're building up waste materials beyond what you can test for. The plants help a lot in terms of taking out nitrate and phosphate and some other minerals that they can use, but there are other minerals that build up that they can't use. They don't use any sodium. There is going to be a buildup of calcium, magnesium, which they use, but not in the amount that's coming in from the tap water. You're going to have evaporation. So that stuff's going to be left behind, and the water is going to get harder and harder if you're
okay, because of the natural evaporation. So you're replenishing and kind of refreshing the stock. We refresh soil for our plants like every 2 years out, you know, with our normal house plants. But it sounds like that's how you're kind of refreshing the nutrients that are in the water and the ratio of everything in the water.
Well, yes, because you're going to also be feeding your plants. And so, again, they're going to be using some of it, but you don't know how much they're using. And it's easier just to, again, export some and keep feeding them and export some and keep feeding them. So you keep a steady amount in the tank.
And when you say feeding, are you adding fertilizer to the new water that you're putting in?
No, you generally feed them every couple of days.
Okay. And is that through liquid or like granules?
I prefer to use a liquid fertilizer, a liquid all-in-one fertilizer. The brand that I like best is Thrive. Company is Nylock G that makes it. Another company that makes a good one is Tropica. The one that you'd want is their specialized formula, which is, I think it's the green one, but it's specialized. They have two. One is just trace elements and one is a complete formula, and it's the complete formula that you'd want to use.
Wow. So you're feeding your plants and you're feeding your fish.
Yep.
With an aquarium.
If you stock the tank properly, you're not feeding the fish enough to support the plants.
Got it. Okay, cool. Because obviously with fish, their secretion is going to have something that the plants can eat as well, right?
Yeah, but not enough.
But not enough. So you're supplementing. And I guess that ratio all depends on however many fish you have and how large the plants are. And I'm sure you dive more into that in your book. But this is a basic, so we're going to keep moving on. So we kind of covered water. It sounds like you need to get at least, and I'm sure these are available on like aquarium stores or online, but a gauge kit and a GH kit to test your water to kind of understand what you're working with and then adjust accordingly.
KH. And GH, yeah.
Okay. And maybe you can send me a link to the kits that you like, and we can put them in the show notes for this episode.
The brand that I usually get is Sarah, S-E-R-A.
Okay, so that's the water. Now let's talk substrate. What are we planting the plants in? Obviously not potting mix. What is the type of substrate that is mimicking that like outdoor environment?
Well, the nice thing is when I started doing this, we had to make all our own substrates. But nowadays, there's so many commercial planted tank substrates available that work so well. I would suggest using one of those. And I think that the best one for beginners, partially because it's really easily available and partially because it's easy to work with, is Fluval Stratum. That one is available even in the big box stores. And it has nutrients in it, but a lot of the soil-based substrates for planted tanks leach ammonia in the first month to 6 weeks. And so they can not only be a problem for fish, but on top of that, they can cause really bad algae problems in the beginning.
Okay.
Planted tank. And that's not, I mean, for somebody who's experienced, they know how to manage that and they just do big water changes. But when I'm talking about big water changes, they're getting in there and draining the tank 3 times a week. That's not something a beginner wants to do.
No.
Right.
I'm still wrapping my head around the once a week water change, let alone a few times a week. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Fluval Stratum doesn't do that. And so I think it's a much better product for beginners.
But you have to buy aquarium specific potting mix.
You will go onto YouTube and some Facebook groups and you'll hear people talking about putting Miracle-Gro organic potting soil in the bottom of their aquarium. Don't do it. You're just going to, you'll end up making a mess, being unhappy. And yes, you will find some people who say they did it and they're happy with it. And
well, that's what I feel like we've realized in the houseplant community as well. No matter what we say or educate on, there's always someone who's going to prove us wrong.
It's not even proving you wrong. It's somebody's done it and they got away with it, or they got away with it for 3 weeks and then they don't come back and tell you when things go bad.
Right. When things go bad. Yeah. 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 So it sounds like I definitely feel like for beginners going with a specific aquarium mix, it sounds like you really like the brand Fluval.
You can't afford that. There is another really, really cheap option that I like a lot. And in that little video that I sent you, that's actually what I used.
And the video she's referencing, we'll link in the show notes, but we obviously can't dive into like step-by-step how to build a terrarium in this short episode. Karen sent a video that we can all watch to kind of get a visual of what we're talking about.
Yeah. If you go to Tractor Supply, and I think there's Tractor Supplies all over the
yeah,
country.
Yeah. Yeah. Tractor Supply for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. There's a product that's meant to clean up oil spills on garage floors. It's called Safety Zorb. It costs $6 for 40 pounds. So there's nobody who can't afford it. And it's a calcined clay product. And it's a nice color. As I said, you can see it in the video. And it makes a quite acceptable substrate for a planted tank. It does not have any nutrients in it. But the nice thing about it is that it's got a high cation exchange capacity.
So, and that sounds like you probably would just feed the plants more. If you plant the plants in that, you're just going to adjust your feeding schedule for them.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually that becomes a nutrient sink and it has more nutrients in it over time. And a lot of the plants that beginners use feed more from the water column anyway. So that's another, you know, if somebody doesn't want to spend the money on fluval stratum, Safety Sorb is another good option and is much better than like aquarium gravel or sand or something like that. And it's cheap and it's pretty. So
let's talk briefly about, so obviously you, what I'm going to assume or what you see from this video you send is you kind of lay the substrate down, then you figure out the planting. I'm sure there's a whole technique there, but how do you feel about gravel on top? Because I do see, you know, I've gone down a YouTube war pole of aquascaping and like you see, you know, the layers of gravel.
You might think it's gravel on top. It's not gravel on top. It's done a different way. It's not gravel on top. They make paths. And I mean, again, we could do a whole video on different aquascaping techniques, but it's not on top. You don't want to put gravel on top of any of these things. It'll just mix in and make a mess. It's not going to hurt anything, but you won't be happy with it in the long run.
So basically you only want the substrate that you're planting the plants in and have the substrate be what's there and let it settle.
For your first tank. And again.
And then you get fancy. Right.
Then you can learn those techniques, but it's not by putting gravel on the top. So if you gravel on the top, you're just going to make a mess.
Okay. Got it. Okay. So that's the substrate. So we've got the water down. We've got the substrates down. Definitely going with a bagged pre-aquarium mix, especially for beginners, because I don't want to mess that up. Let's talk lighting, because I feel like that's what a lot of people struggle with. And that's also probably the biggest investment people might make. Can you get away with just putting, you know, setting up your first aquarium and putting it near your window? Or no. You must have some sort of aquarium light.
If you're buying one of these little kit tanks, the nice thing since the advent of LED lighting is that the aquarium manufacturers, since LED lighting is cheap, is that they've gone actually in the direction of almost overlighting these little tanks rather than underlighting them. And if anything, people have a hard time because the lighting is too strong rather than too weak. The big thing that I would be careful of is that if you're buying a kit tank, there's a few that have a light that's just in the middle, and you know, the tank will be this big and the light will be in the middle. That's bad because the plants that are all around the edges aren't going to get any light at all. And the other thing that you want to be careful of is that some of the cheaper ones, the filter and the light will be on the same plug. And the photo period is really important. And so you want to be able to put your light on a timer and have it on for about 8 hours a day. It can be, depending on a number of other things, could be up to 12 hours a day, certainly not longer than that. But you want it on a steady photo period, coming on at the same time, going off at the same time every day. And the problem with that is you can't have the filter going on and off. The filter has to stay on. So you need the filter and the light to be on separate plugs. And some of these cheaper big box store type kits have just a single plug that everything is on. And so be careful when you're buying a kit that it's one that has the light and the filter separate.
Got it. Now, what if I have a tank and a filter from, you know, like an old aquarium or something, but I want to try a light? Do you have to buy an aquarium specific grow light, or can you buy an LED light, like a grow light for my houseplants and hang it over an aquarium? Does it have to be like waterproof, or is there anything special about them?
You either have to have it high enough so that it's not going to be hit by the water, or you need to get an aquarium one. Most aquariums are going to have either a piece of glass between the light and the water, or else it's going to be in a hood. It's not very often you can have an open top aquarium, but then the lights are going to be up a little higher. There's not a whole lot of lights that can stand having water splash directly on them without bad consequences.
Okay. And in the video that you sent, which is a really fun time lapse of you setting up an aquarium, you put black, what it looks like is felt. I know it's not, but you put black material. Is that for aesthetic, or is that having to do something with the lighting?
No, just because it looks nice to have something on the back of the tank.
To have a background so you can see the plants against the black. Okay, cool. Is there a certain wattage or like lumen, like color on the color spectrum that you're looking for specifically for an aquarium light?
The only things that matter to plants are the photoperiod, the length of time that the lights are on. And our plants come from the tropics. So between the photoperiod would be the shortest would be 8 hours, but up to 12 hours, not shorter than 8 hours. The intensity is the most important thing. And to a lesser extent, the spectrum. The spectrum is mostly important for flowering, though. And just like with houseplants, we don't worry so much about the flowering. And I'm sure you know, it's not significantly different between terrestrial plants and aquatic plants. That, you know, they use the red end and the blue end and not so much the green part, but they can use the green part too. And our lights fill in the green part because that's what we see best. So really, you can use any light that looks appealing to you. I would say that most people like the look of lights that are around 6,500K. And you will hear people say that, oh, you need 6,500K to grow. Well, they say it about houseplants too, but it's not true. You can grow houseplants with any Kelvin rating. Doesn't have anything to do with growing plants. It only has to do with what our eyes see. And that's true with aquarium plants too. They need the light to be the right amount of brightness. But if you get it too bright, you're going to get algae, which you don't want.
Yeah. What do you shoot for in terms of intensity? You said intensity is the most important part. So what should you look for when shopping?
That's the hard part, because the only thing that counts is PAR, photosynthetic
active radiation.
And I have a PAR meter, but I can't imagine that most people do. So just get a light that fits your size tank. They're not that expensive if you're getting a tank that doesn't have a light that comes with it. And then play with the intensity. It's unlikely that it won't be enough light for beginner type plants. And then play with the intensity by either raising it up or lowering it. And to raise it, you can put it the light on little blocks on the ends or hang it. Or the other way that I cut down the light is to put a piece of, you can hardly see it, this is a little piece of window screen that I keep under one that's over here.
Oh, that's smart to use window screen to filter it.
Yeah. And if that's not enough, you can use the black plastic needlepoint screen. That's even more shade.
Okay.
You can build up different layers of shade underneath it, or bubble wrap you can use as shade. Different things to shade to cut the amount of light down if you're getting too much light. But that's a better way of doing it than try to cut down the photoperiod. Because the problem is, if you cut down the photoperiod too much, if you cut down the day length, you end up putting the plants into winter growth. And winter growth looks different and it's not attractive. And so you don't want to do that.
Got it. So it sounds like a light is necessary. We'll link to some that you recommend in the show notes.
Just buy something that fits your tank. This is not rocket science, really.
Okay. I want to ask you your top recommended beginner plants. But before that, I just wanted to hit you with a couple of other listener questions. Where's the best place to buy supplies? You've given some great recommendations on different brands, but where do you recommend beginners? Do you recommend going to an aquarium store, a pet store?
I always recommend supporting your local independent aquarium store if you have a good one nearby. That's always who I would prefer to have people support. If that's not an option, I don't care for the big boxes. They are getting a little better in terms of the quality of stuff that they have available than they used to be, but then it's online and I don't know that there's particularly one that's better than the other. I've bought some stuff from Marine Depot and they seem to ship without any shipping fees if it's over a certain amount. So I've been happy with them, but I bought stuff from on Amazon too. So,
okay. Then I thought this was an interesting question. A listener wrote in saying, I have a simple 1.5 gallon tank with a filter heater with one betta fish and a couple of plastic plants. Can I add plants to this already planted fish tank? What would you recommend?
I would recommend that they get themselves a bigger tank right away, because a betta doesn't belong in a 1.5 gallon container.
Okay. So say they had a 5 or 10 gallon tank with a betta with the plastic plants. Is it as simple as swapping it out, or do you have to take everything out, rescape it, set it, let it cycle, and then put the betta back in?
Well, your cycle is already there because you've got your filter and they've got a heater. So all they need is a bigger tank because that tank is woefully too small. And they don't even need a 5 or 10 gallon tank. If that tank that I did in the Scrapscape thing is a 4 gallon tank, and that's fine for a betta.
But can you simply take out the plastic and put in the live?
Not really, because I'm sure she has a crummy substrate in there too. So she needs a better substrate, and it's just easier. I mean, a gallon and a half of water, just get rid of it. And even a 5 gallon tank, to take it down and set it up right, you're talking about an hour and a half of work. Just do it right and empty it out and start over again.
Because she's probably going to need better substrate.
Yeah. Take your filter and make sure that your filter material, don't wash it because you want to preserve your bacteria, but put your filter material in a plastic bag so that it stays damp because that's your good bacteria. You want to keep it alive. Do your rescape, put your betta in a deli cup. He'll be perfectly happy in a deli cup for the hour and a half it takes you to redo your tank. Set up your new tank, set it up right, and fill it with dechlorinated water and put your filter back on it and put your bit of betta back in and you'll be set to go.
Okay. And because the bacteria is already in the filter, it'll cycle fast enough for the betta to be cool, to be okay.
It's essentially cycled. It doesn't need anything else. Yeah.
Another listener question, CO2 systems, are they worth it? Are we okay with CO tablets or liquids?
CO2 systems are absolutely 100% worth it, but you don't have to have a CO2 system. I would suggest for somebody just getting started that they start without a CO2 system and use the types of plants that we'll talk about do not need a supplemental CO2 system. The tank that I set up in that little video does not have a CO2 system on it. The plants in that tank don't need CO2. And I think for a nano size tank, I don't want plants growing so fast in a teeny tank like that, that I need to keep chopping them out every week. I want that to be a slow growing mm-hmm. tank that just can sit there. And that tank is right beside my stove. And I just want it to look nice. I don't want to have to deal with it on daily basis. So a tank like that, I would prefer not to put CO2 on it. But my big tanks, those always have CO2 on them, even if they're relatively slow growth systems, just because the CO2 makes them more stable, the plants grow better, there's less algae. There's many, many reasons to use CO2. But as far as liquid carbon products, they're not. All of those are glutaraldehyde based, which is it's a really nasty chemical. OSHA has big papers on how to deal with it in the workplace. And it's not a nice chemical. It's used to clean up around Ebola. It's one of the few things that will kill Ebola. It's not something that humans should be touching, let alone pouring into aquariums or using without PPE, really.
So get the system or bust. Don't bother with the tablets because they could be potentially dangerous.
The tablets, I'm not sure what's in them. I suspect those are not glutaraldehyde. The tablets, I suspect, are probably baking soda and citric acid pressed into something, and then you get them wet and they bubble up. But the problem with that is that most of the CO2 is going to bust right up out of the top of the water. And then it's also completely uncontrollable. You have no idea how much CO2 you're getting into the water. So that's not something that I'd use either. But I think that's probably safe for humans and not particularly good for your tank. But the liquid ones are absolutely not CO2, and they are a dangerous chemical. And so I would absolutely stay away from all of the liquid ones.
Okay. So it sounds like CO2 systems are great, but maybe for like a 2.0 thing. And if you're starting out as a beginner, don't necessarily worry about CO2 or let it intimidate you. As long as you've got a filter, you're good. I love this question because it opens us right into top 5 beginner plants and top 5 advanced plants. How do you determine what plants are most beneficial for the ecosystem that you're creating? Or we can also look at it as just like, how do you suggest people select plants?
That's a little easier. I think that people have to be really careful when they go into pet stores, because a lot of pet stores, particularly the big boxes, sell plants that are really house plants. Like, you'll go in and you'll see aluminum plants, you'll see mondo grass, hemigraphis, bunches and bunches of house plants that are bundled up into stems with weights around the bottom and stuck underwater and sold for aquariums. And they don't grow underwater ever. And so people take them home, put them in their aquariums, they die, and the people feel really bad that they killed all these plants. And they say, I can't grow aquarium plants. And it's like, nobody can grow those. You didn't do anything wrong.
They're not aquarium plants, right? Those are house plants.
It drives me nuts. But the only mistake they made was being taken advantage of by these pet stores. And again, we can put it in the show notes that Florida Aquatic Nurseries has a great website that I redesigned for them. And pretty much every plant that's available commercially in the United States is on there, and with a little write-up of how to, it's not extensive, but how to grow it in the aquarium, whether it needs CO2, how much light it needs.
Oh, that sounds amazing. That sounds like the answer to all our prayers.
And it actually includes those terrarium plants, but it'll say that this is a terrarium plant, don't grow it underwater. So make sure that the plants that you're buying actually are aquarium plants to start with, and find out whether it can grow in the kind of tank that you have set up. If you have a low light tank without CO2, don't buy a plant that can only grow under high light with supplemental CO2. And there are lots of plants that you can't grow unless you have supplemental CO2. So just don't buy those plants.
Okay. So let's talk about, for beginners, what would be your top five recommended beginner plants for someone like me who wants to kind of experiment with baby's first fish tank, planted aquarium?
So the absolute best cast iron plant is Anubias. And there's a bunch of different varieties. They're all under the same species, which is Barteri, but they come from fairly large plants to Nana Petite, which is a teeny tiny little plant, and several different leaf shapes. We used to jokingly call it the plastic plant that grows, because it will keep one leaf for well over a year. So its most annoying aspect is that the leaves stay on it for so long that if you have algae problems in the tank, that the algae will get on the leaves because the leaves last so long. So that's probably the number one beginner plant. Java fern is another excellent one. This third one, we have to qualify a little bit. There's a plant that's relatively new on the, and when I say new on the market, within the last 5 years or so, it's called Bucephalandra. It's another small aroid. It's from Borneo. And the thing with this is that it's available a couple of different ways. Some of them are tissue cultured, and those are great. People should absolutely buy those and not feel bad about it at all. And you can actually buy those, and they're fine to buy at the big box stores. You can buy tissue cultured ones hanging up in Petco by the bettas. The problem is that Bucephalandra are still being taken out of the wild and sold in huge quantities directly from Borneo and through any number of different sources here in the United States, mail order, and in pet stores. If you're buying Bucephalandra that's loose, that's not in a little tissue culture cup, you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that it was a wild collected plant, and just don't do it.
Sustainability is very important in this conversation. So thank you for sharing that.
That's one that I have to qualify. If you're going to get tissue cultured ones, by all means, it's a wonderful beginner plant. It's very variable in terms of leaf color and shape. They're hardy as nails, great little plants, but just get the tissue cultured ones. You want to be able to balance some faster growing plants with slower growing plants. And those three that we've talked about so far are slow growing plants, and they're very, very hardy, but they do grow slowly. The next two are fast-growing plants, and so they'll help you keep your water quality better, and they'll keep on top of algae for you. Water sprite, which is a fern, but it grows very, very quickly. Scientific name is Ceratopterus thalactoides. And that's a nice, fast-growing plant. It can either grow with its roots in the substrate or it can grow floating, and a lovely plant. And then Hygrophila is the genus. There's a number of different species, and there are some that are more difficult that you wouldn't want to use. But the giant Hygro and Hygrophila deformis, which is water wisteria, those are really, really easy ones. And they grow fast. They're great beginner plants. So those would be my five. That actually ends up being more, but, you know,
amazing. Five. Okay.
Beginner ones.
Okay. I feel like I'm moving one more time, but once I settle, I'm going to take this list of beginner plants to my local aquarium shop. And definitely I'm going to be ordering a kit. I'm not going to try and piecemeal this together for my first one, but I'm excited. I mean, it's interesting. This is like a whole different, it's interesting within plant people. There are like these sub genres of plant people, aquatic people, orchid people, Hoya people. And I feel like this aquatic plant passion is like completely this like subsect of plant people. I love it. So it's wild. We just talked for over an hour and barely covered the surface of what it would take to plant up our aquariums, but you have a literal step-by-step book on how to do it. I'll definitely be following along when I get the chance to plant mine up in probably early 2022. Where can people find you and your book and more resources? Because you also have a great resource section on your website if people want to keep learning and digging around.
My website is sunkengardens.net, and my book is Sunken Gardens, and you can get it on Amazon. I used to lecture widely, and now because of COVID, I'm not. I still do Zoom lectures, and those are usually open to the public. So if people want to see them, I have a group that I started, and what I love about it is that unlike, you know how a lot of Facebook groups, they have moderators, but they're just sort of people. They're nice people, but they just moderate. Mm-hmm. Our little Planted Nano and Betta Tank Facebook group, which is the name of it. You can just look it up that way. All of our moderators are actually very highly skilled planted tank people. And so our group works a little bit differently. We don't have people who just jump in and say, well, I do it this way and I do it that way and I do it the other way. And it just kind of gallops on out of control. And some people don't like that because they don't get to say what they think. But the good thing is that people who come there can get really, really good top quality advice because there's this group of moderators who actually know what they're doing. And those are the people who answer the questions. And not that we won't let other people answer, but if somebody's going off on a tangent and it's not good advice, they really do get shut down.
Well, it sounds like if anybody's interested in starting their first aquarium, hopping into that Facebook group would be a great choice. And we'll link to it in the show notes. So thank you so much for breaking this all down. I feel like I could probably have you back for, you know, four more episodes. It's a lot of information to cover, but can't wait to work through the book. And I really appreciate this totally different sect of plant parenthood. So thank you so much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
All right. I know this episode was a doozy. Thank you, Karen, for these deep dives. I learned so much from this deep dive because I didn't know much about aquatic plants. And I think this episode definitely serves as just like a fundamentals basic of aquatic plants and how they work, right? And then if you guys are interested in a 2.0 or a 3.0 episode, let me know. And I'm happy to maybe bring Karen on or bring on a different aquatic expert on and continue the conversation for getting into the nitty gritty. I do have to say there are some amazing YouTube channels that just do this, and it's very mesmerizing, kind of like the bonsai YouTube channels. You can like go through like a K-hole of just like these YouTube videos on planting aquariums. There's something about the water that makes it very calming. We have to move one more time, plant friends. I kid you not, this has been the most insane year. But once we find our like forever home, I definitely want to try a little fishy aquarium with some planted plants. I definitely think because I'm a beginner, I'm going to go the kit route for sure. We've linked to the kit and all of those awesome options that Karen talked about in the show notes. And feel free to check them out. And let me know if you end up planting an aquarium after this. I want to hear, and show me your planted aquariums on Instagram and tag me if you've got one. I'm super curious now that Karen has definitely kind of whet my appetite on this topic, and I'm excited to continue learning about it. So thanks again to Soltech Solutions for sponsoring the episode. And until next time, as always, I'm here to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section and leave us a review? It would be tremendously helpful for the show, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more planty content or ways to help and support the show or engage with our community, we've got a ton of options for you. So first, there's the free Bloom and Grow Plant Parent Personality Test. It is a super fun 3-minute test that I made for you that pairs you with your plant parent personality profile, where you'll learn your planty strengths and weaknesses and get a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you. The test lives at bloomandgrowradio.com/personality, and you have to let me know what your results are on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Bloom and Grow Radio. If you're interested in supporting Bloom and Grow Radio, consider becoming a Patreon plant friend of the show. Patreon plant friends are members of the community who support the show monetarily on a monthly basis for as little as $4 a month, and these magical humans help support the show and bring our content to as many planty eyes and ears as possible. Once you join, you'll also get the secret password to our Facebook group, which I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. We have a lot of fun over there. You can become a Patreon plant friend at patreon.com/bloomandgrowradio. And of course, you can also just join our newsletter that I like to call the Garden Club. When you join our Garden Club, you'll receive a free download of the exclusive Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print, which is so adorable. And I'll slide into your inboxes, usually only around twice a month, with plant care tips, recent episodes, and announcements. You can join at bloomandgrowradio.com/community. And for anything else, plant friends, I'm here for you. So feel free to drop me a line when you have an idea for an episode, an event, or maybe even if you're a planty business interested in sponsoring the show. Thanks again for listening. It is my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up, so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya, and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, Plant Friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.